Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. The Trudeau government's assisted dying legislation is now law after the Senate concedes in a parliamentary showdown with the House of Commons. We speak with senators on both sides of this controversial debate, and we hear why the matter may still end up before the courts. Start practicing. The House of Commons approved a bill this week that changes the lyrics to our national anthem, making O Canada gender neutral. We hear from MPs about the new words and fulfilling the wish of a dying colleague. Imagine having your name on an ISIS kill list, but not being told about it until a reporter contacts you for an interview a week after the list was sent to authorities. That's what happened with one Canadian woman. We get to the bottom of this matter with McLean's writer Nikki Weird. And sticking with the issue of terrorism, is ISIS committing genocide? For weeks, the Trudeau government had been avoiding that term, prompting criticisms from the opposition. But this week, the government changed its tune after a report from the UN. We hear from an expert on when it's appropriate for governments to start saying genocide. For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
Yeas pour, 44, 44. Nays count, 28, 28. Abstentions, abstention, nil, aucun.
Accordingly, the motion is carried.
With that vote, the appointed Senate bowed to the will of the elected House of Commons and made the Trudeau government's controversial legislation on assisted dying law. Friday afternoon, the Senate voted to approve a government motion, which therefore meant they were passing Bill C-14, which for days had been volleyed back and forth between the two chambers. The main sticking point was eligibility. The Senate had made 7 amendments to the bill, which were largely accepted by the House, but the government rejected a key change from the upper chamber that would have opened up access for a broader range of patients, including those whose sole condition is a mental health problem. The government's rejection and the Senate's approval of that now means that the more restrictive requirements are in place. So not only does a patient need to be facing irremediable suffering from a grievous medical condition, but their natural death needs to be foreseeable. The government, of course, is pleased with the Senate's passage of the legislation. The Justice Minister released a statement saying the bill strikes the right balance between individual rights and protections for the vulnerable. The Canadian Medical Association is also pleased, especially since the bill provides more clear legal protections for doctors and other medical staff who may help a patient end their life. Since assisted dying became legal on June 6th, there's been a lot of confusion without a federal law in place and only a court ruling and provincial guidelines to govern the practice. Now, this whole debate was quite divisive in both chambers, with MPs and senators showing splits even within their own parties. Independent Liberal Senator James Cowan believes the government's bill is unconstitutional because it's too restrictive, and he tried right until the end to expand eligibility.
I'm disappointed, but I respect the decision. I think we had a good, solid debate. People had held their views, and that's what a democracy is all about. I accept the result.
How do you think this is going to play out? You felt this is unconstitutional, so do you think this is going to be heading back to the courts no matter what?
Well, I think that somebody sooner or later, probably sooner, will challenge the constitutionality of the restrictive criteria, and then it'll be back in the courts. That's why I think that when Senator Harrell put out our proposition this morning, that it be the government that take it to the court. Rather than putting individuals or individual organizations to the thing, I think that was a better solution. But the majority decided that that's not the way to go, so we are where we are.
Now, this whole parliamentary showdown about assisted death also sparked a conversation about the role of a more independent Senate and whether or not it should stand its ground on important issues like this or give in to the will of the people. The government's representative in the Senate, Peter Harder, weighed in on that after the vote.
There are lessons here to be drawn between how the renewed Senate engages with the House of Commons when there are differences. And I expect that if you have a more independent-minded Senate, you will have more occasions in which there is that different perspective brought to bear. But I would note a number of senators in their speeches today said, from their point of view, the accountability chain in our democracy rests in the other chamber, and that therefore, while they supported amendments that had been rejected, we're now supporting the bill because of that engagement between our chamber and the other chamber. And I suspect that that's going to be a feature of future processes in which there are bills of difference. It's not a cookie cutter. It will evolve over time, but I do think there are important lessons here that Canadians should draw from. What does it mean to have a more independent-minded Senate, and how does that Senate still respect the democratically elected processes of a Parliament, of a House of Commons?
To get more in-depth on this vote and the role of the Senate, I was able to catch up with Senator George Baker, who sponsored the assisted dying legislation in the upper chamber.
It's been a long, rather intense parliamentary battle, if you will, but now the bill has been passed. How do you feel that this is now over?
Well, this is a landmark decision in Canada. It sets a parliamentary history because, yes, the similar laws are in place in five states in the United States, but you have to be terminally ill there, death within 6 months. In some of the jurisdictions in Europe, yes, it's a more relaxed system than this bill is. But what the House of Commons has overwhelmingly decided to do is to restrict it to persons where there is a reasonable foreseeability of death. But then the law goes on to say, but the exact time does not have to be determined. In other words, it's left up to the physicians, who are the right people to make those decisions as to whether or not the physician-assisted death will happen. With the proper safeguards against criminal prosecution for hospitals and nurses and health providers and people who assist in physician-assisted death. So, this is the best we could have had in our Canadian Parliament. The Senate was more permissive in its decision, passing an amendment, a major amendment to the bill that said, look, let's open it up. That was passed in the Senate. The House of Commons overwhelmingly rejected it. And so on the basis of our parliamentary democracy, we have to, at that point, turn around and show deference to the House of Commons.
Yeah, so you were one of the senators, obviously one of more than 40 senators, who said, you know what, we have to give in to the House of Commons on this. Why is that important? Because some said this last vote sort of came down to the role of the Senate, whether it is to stand your ground or whether it is to give in to the House when they insist. Why do you think it's important that you do give in to the House of Commons?
Well, there's a principle behind an appointed Senate. And it goes back to Sir John A. Macdonald 150 years ago when he said the role of the Senate is to be sober second thought to the House of Commons, but the Senate should never go against the wishes of the people, should never set itself against the wishes of the people, meaning the elected representatives in the House of Commons. You know, the Senate is quoted more often than the House of Commons in case law in Canada, in our courts, in our quasi-judicial bodies and tribunals who have to make decisions on a daily basis. This decision here over this very complex subject that everybody is so concerned about set a precedent, because it's never before happened that you had a piece of legislation that passed with an overwhelming majority in the House of Commons, was sent to the Senate, and the Senate, on a great majority vote, said, look, this is not good enough, we're going to be more permissive in this legislation, and sent it back. But what is telling in this? Why does the Senate then have to bow to the wishes of the elected people? Well, the elected representatives in the House of Commons, on a vote of 240-52, rejected the very amendment that we had put forward and passed in the Senate. So the question is, what do we do here? I mean, do we send it back again? Do we try to, well, there was a motion, as you saw, in the Senate to try to go by what I call, you're going by the back door what you couldn't do in the front door, and to send it to the Supreme Court of Canada. But overwhelmingly, the Senate said, no, we have to bow in this case to the wishes of the House of Commons. We're not elected. They're elected. They're responsible to the people of Canada. They have to answer. We don't.
But can you understand the frustrations of your colleagues who said, listen, I see this as an unconstitutional bill, in my opinion, and I cannot support a bill that I feel is unconstitutional?
Absolutely. And you will always find that. I mean, you will find people who will say something is unconstitutional and I cannot accept it. Well, that's the independence of the Senate. You know, people are independent. They're supposed to, as the Prime Minister said, and I congratulate the Prime Minister for congratulating the Senate on amending his bills. You get to the point where the majority must rule in the Senate, the appointed Senate. But, you know, there's only so far you can go. I know there's a great number of senators, great famous lawyers, constitutional experts here in the Senate, who wanted to further amend this bill, who voted against this bill. But as you saw, the vast majority said, no, we're not elected. Hey, you want to make legislation, senators? You want to really make legislation? Go out and get elected. Go out and get elected. Run for office. You are there as sober second thought, as second thought, not primary thought. You have a function, yes, to amend legislation. But once the House of Commons has rejected it, you do not have the jurisdiction, Senate, to change it, what the majority in the House of Commons rejected that you already suggested.
So you think they were overstepping their bounds?
Absolutely. It would be overstepping your bounds. Look, the Senate is without jurisdiction, they call it. They have no jurisdiction to, once they pass an amendment, send it to the House of Commons, and the House of Commons overwhelmingly says no, the Senate does not have the authority, in my opinion and in the opinion of the majority of senators, to then send it back to the House of Commons and say, no, you got to consider this again, or we're going to do by the back door what we couldn't do by the front door.
Do you think assisted dying is going to end up back at the Supreme Court no matter what law you guys put in place?
I think it will end up back in the Supreme Court. And the reason why I say it is this, is that there will be instances where people will feel as if their constitutional rights have been violated, like the experts who appeared before our committees and some of the senators felt so strongly about. Somebody's going to say, look, my Section 7 charter rights are violated, fundamental justice. There shouldn't be a reasonable foreseeability of death. So this will be challenged in the courts. But the point is this. If we had gone with the more relaxed system and taken it out, if we were successful in doing that, then it would still be challenged in our courts because of what they call public interest litigation. And in that, any organization who feels they represent vulnerable people, for example, people who have disabilities, and they would say, look, this law is too permissive. One of our persons could be at a time of weakness because of pressure maybe of family or outside of family, they may feel in a moment of weakness that they want to have their lives taken away from them, although they have no reasonable foreseeability of death. And that's the danger. So those organizations, if we had gone and been successful in doing what we attempted to do, then we would be then open to public interest litigation. It would take about a week for this to end up in the lower courts in one of the provinces, then to the Superior Court, then to the Court of Appeal, and then to the Supreme Court of Canada.
Do you feel that Canadians are safer with a law rather than allowing the Supreme Court ruling to stand as is?
Well, I think that one of the most important things on this subject is the fact that the law is there. That somebody has that assurance that if they ever get to that position, that the law is there. That they won't attempt suicide, for example, attempt to kill themselves. They'll know in the back of their minds that if they get to this point of reasonable foreseeability of death, they're in incredibly unbearable pain and they have a grievous and irremediable condition. In other words, can't be cured. So that is one thing.
But what about those patients who say that with the law in place as it is now, they're going to starve themselves? They're going to take actions to harm themselves further to make sure that they hit that point of death being reasonably foreseeable? foreseeable, and all the government in this law is doing is creating more suffering for them.
I have heard that criticism. I don't believe it. And the reason why I don't believe it is this. We had two ministers appear before the Senate, and the Minister of Health stated that if somebody had, and she named the illnesses, she said, as a physician and as the Minister of Health, that person has a reasonable foreseeability of death. In the committee, the Department of Justice, when they were asked to define reasonable foreseeability of death in the case of somebody who self-medicates, who takes the medicine, not having it injected by the doctor to cause death, but they can take it at home under this legislation. And the question was asked, well, how long can they hold it at home before they self-administer? And the answer was, well, it could be weeks, it could be months, it could be a couple of years. You know, so this concern that reasonable foreseeability of death is sometime is that it means you're terminally ill is just plain wrong.
That was Senator George Baker discussing the passage of the Trudeau government's assisted dying bill. Maclean's has more coverage on this debate with articles you can find on macleans.ca and a piece that's going to appear in next week's issue on how assisted death is shifting attitudes towards suicide. Still to come on the show, in a touching moment in the House of Commons, MPs vote to change the lyrics to O Canada. A woman on an ISIS kill list is alarmed to be informed of this serious threat, not by police, but by a Maclean's journalist. And why was there a heated debate over the term genocide? And why there was a heated debate over the term genocide? Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Coming up on the show, we take a look at a Canadian woman who's on an ISIS kill list but wasn't informed of that by police. And we have an expert weigh in on the political debate over whether or not ISIS has been committing genocide. But first, that was the sound of the House of Commons on Wednesday night when MPs held an impromptu singing of a new version of our national anthem. It was a touching moment after MPs approved a bill that makes O Canada gender neutral by changing the line "In all thy sons command" to "In all of us command." It was a passionate debate, made even more emotional though because of the man who brought the bill forward, Liberal MP Maurel Bélanger. Bélanger had been pushing for this change for years, but after the last election, he was diagnosed with ALS. His health quickly declined as he made one last push for a gender-neutral anthem. The Liberals sped the bill through the parliamentary process, and Bélanger was in attendance for the vote, looking gaunt, unable to speak, and confined to a wheelchair.
Monsieur Bélanger.
Mr. Kahari.
After the vote, Environment Minister Catherine McKenna told me it was an emotional moment.
Well, it's just an honor to be there with Maurel Bélanger. I was so thrilled to see him there. He's worked really hard to promote, this change to our national anthem, but more broadly to promote women in politics. He was a great mentor to me. And I think it's time that we have a national anthem that's inclusive and brings us together. And I think this was a great change. And as I say, it's also a great celebration of everything Maurel's done.
After the House of Commons broke into an impromptu version of what could be the new O Canada after it gets through the Senate, did you feel anything? Was it emotional to be there?
It's especially emotional for me because Maurel really was a mentor, and I know how hard he's worked on this. And it's great that he was able to be here. It's been hard for him, and it's a lot of effort for him to be here. But to be able to sing the new national anthem, which I hope will be the new national anthem with him present, was really incredible.
And the Senate is the next test for this bill. Are you confident it will pass the Senate at all?
I'm confident that they will realize that making a gender neutral national anthem, it's already gender neutral in French, is just the right thing to do.
But not everybody was proud of the result. The changing of the lyrics didn't sit well with a lot of Conservative MPs. Many of them oppose the change, including Saskatchewan's Tom Lukiwski.
Can you explain why you don't think we should have an all-of-us command in our national anthem?
Well, number one, I think that there has been rushed. Listen, I have great admiration for Merle and great sympathy for the terrible disease that he's got. But Bill should be debated and voted upon on its merits. This one's been rushed through, in my opinion. It's a national anthem. It's our national anthem. Canadians haven't been consulted. The last time they were was back, I think it was 2010, when we had it in our throne speech. A polling was done after that, showed that 75% of Canadians didn't want to see a change. So I think that there should have been more adequate consultation. Having said that, I know exactly why the Liberals and the NDP are voting. I can understand that if it was one of our colleagues, perhaps my position would be changed just because of the sympathy for one of my colleagues. But I just think on its own merits, nothing to do with Mr. Bélanger, but on its own merits, I just don't think it's something I could support at this point in time.
Aside from rushing, is there any other, like changing the lyrics? Is that something you fundamentally don't agree with?
Look, it's been a part of our heritage for how long now? Over 100 years. And I can understand those that say that its original content, original words, were closer to what Mr. Bélanger wanted. But all of us have been comfortable with this for the last 100 years. And most of my constituents have told me they don't like the changes either.
To hear more about the arguments against a gender-neutral national anthem, listen to last week's episode when I interviewed Conservative House Leader Andrew Scheer. Also, if you want to find out what some of your favorite Canadian musicians feel about the change to O Canada, check out our article on macleans.ca. Still to come, how a Canadian woman found out she was on an ISIS kill list, and why MPs got into a heated debate about whether or not ISIS is committing genocide. Welcome back to Macleans on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Still to come on the show, when is it okay to use the term genocide? It's a big question, and we have an expert weighing in after the Trudeau government refused to use that word to describe the actions of ISIS and then quickly changed tune. But first, this week, ISIS released a kill list of more than 8,000 names, urging supporters to target these people around the world, including 150 Canadians. It was disturbing news, and Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale says Canadian authorities are looking into it.
Well, we take that matter and all matters in relation to international terrorism extremely seriously. You can be assured that the police and security authorities of Canada are taking this matter with the gravity that it demands, and that they will be doing their very best within all their powers and authorities to keep all Canadians safe. I should not comment any further than that, but I just want to assure you that when this kind of a threat emerges, number one, it's assessed for credibility. I won't comment on that one way or another. But when this kind of a threat to Canadians is put into the public domain, all of the security and police and intelligence agencies of the Government of Canada respond in a robust way to keep the country safe.
Is it a serious threat?
I would not comment on that. It's just not appropriate for me to wade into a play-by-play color commentary. That would be contrary to the security interests of the country.
Now, it can be very unnerving to find out that your name is on a list like this. But it may also be unnerving to find that information out from a journalist calling for an interview rather than the authorities. That's exactly what happened this week when Macleans writer Nikki Weert tried to contact one of the people on that ISIS list. I spoke with Nikki about what happened.
All right, Nikki, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, so first of all, just let our listeners know that we're not going to be using this woman's name or any identifying details about her just for her own protection. She's not really happy about all of this. But why don't you start from the start? What exactly happened? You received an assignment to cover this so-called kill list from ISIS.
Yeah, so first thing I had to do was get the list, which I did from Memory, which is the monitoring group based out of Washington. They sent me the list. I went through it for the names that are from Canada, which was roughly 150, and I sent an email to a few of those people from the emails that were provided on that list. A couple hours later, I received a call from an unknown number. On the other end, a woman said hi. I said hi back, not sure who it was. And she said, "You emailed me about my name being on some kind of list?" And I replied, "Yeah, have RCMP talked to you?" And she said, "No." So I ended up having about a 10-minute conversation with her just, you know, about how it felt to receive this news that she was on this kill list from a journalist and not, you know, from a police officer who obviously would know a lot more than I do about the seriousness of this.
And how did she react to that? Was she alarmed? Was she scared? What was her reaction?
Yeah, she was very panicked. She said she felt gross, that she felt violated. She said that, you know, she has a very limited social media presence. She doesn't have Facebook. She doesn't have Twitter. So she was really shocked that somehow this group was able to obtain her email address and her home address. She was very, very shocked.
And this list sort of came about maybe through a hacker group, is that correct, from associated with ISIS?
Yeah, it's a pro-ISIS hacking group. They released the list. But when I was talking to the monitoring group down in the States, the director there told me that this list is unlike any other list that they found in the past. It had a total of 8,300 names on it, or just over 8,300, which is a lot more than they've seen in the past. And it also didn't really have a rhyme or reason. The names on the list weren't, you know, affiliated with the military. You know, in the past, they've released lists of addresses of drone operators, that kind of thing. This list was pretty random.
So that means it's not really targeted then. So it's just maybe just trying to scalp information off the internet and then throw it out there. For what reason, really?
Just kind of a call to action, I guess, for people in that have access to the list, you know, providing these names on a kill list, it was called. And the list came out, I think, on June 7th. That's when the monitoring group found it and gave it to the authorities. So I think the scary thing is just knowing that your personal information, your home address, your email address is out there on the internet for anybody to find, really, for 8-9 days without knowing.
So I guess in situations like this, the big question that pops up is this actually a serious threat? Are they actually trying to get people to go out and kill these Canadians on this random list? Or is this more of an empty threat just to cause fear?
I talked to a former CSIS agent who worked with CSIS from 1988 to 1990. He also runs an intelligence firm here in the city, here in Ottawa. His name's David Harris. And yeah, he said it's just to promote fear.
One of the key questions, of course, among analysts would be what might be the commonality, if any, between those named in such a list? Does it appear to be, in significant measure, a random selection of individuals? In which case, if the ISIS provenance should be true bill, then it may be an effort to sow generalized fear within much broader audiences than any of the people immediately named and involved. The idea that anyone could, on an almost random basis, be selected for adverse attention. If people have more narrow or have narrow and identifiable common denominators between them, say for example some affiliation to military security or intelligence elements, then that might suggest a different level of seriousness and or targeting. But whether ISIS or anybody else can or might be prepared to make good in any way on the threats implicit in such a listing is another matter. And it's part, of course, of what can be destabilizing within our own society.
So whether the threat is empty or not, I think this whole situation does raise a big question as to why, which, of course, you talked about, why a journalist is the person letting this woman know that she's on this kill list and not the authorities, especially since you say that they had it for a week or so before you had your hands on this list?
Yeah, I called the RCMP and they responded with an email, you know, just the basic comment that they've been giving all of the news organizations saying that they're taking this seriously and they're looking into it and they've been contacting everyone off the list. And I responded just asking, you know, when do you expect to contact everybody? And they couldn't tell me. It was not within his knowledge.
150 names is not a lot, but they still weren't able to contact all those people despite having all their names on this list.
Yeah, and, you know, I did raise this question with Mr. Harris. I said, you know, is it reasonable that I was able to contact someone in an hour or two and the RCMP hadn't contacted her and they had the list for a week? And he said, well, you know, given the fact that I'm not running multiple criminal investigations and counterterrorism investigations and, you know, it is kind of reasonable. But that being said, it might not be reasonable to somebody whose name is on this list.
So what is she going to do now, this woman that you spoke with? I mean, I don't know what I would do in that scenario. I would probably look towards the police for guidance on how to deal with this. But if they hadn't contacted her yet, what is she planning to do about all of this?
I told her, you know, call police after we're done talking, you know, just kind of figure out what you should be doing, what your next step should be doing. But she said she's immediately going to start kind of erasing her online presence, changing her email address, changing her passwords, changing her banking information. You know, this is a list of some of the information, some of her personal information. Who really knows how much more is out there?
Is she looking to change her identity, move, anything like that? I mean, how far is she willing to go with all of this?
We didn't talk about that. I think that she was going to wait until she talked to police to see, you know, what is the seriousness of this that they know of, and then go from there. And I, you know, I'm hoping that she'll be in contact with me again afterwards.
So essentially, because ISIS or an ISIS-affiliated group randomly chose her name, she now has to turn her online presence upside down and change a lot of things about her life only because they just picked her name.
Yeah, and she didn't even have, from what it sounds like, she didn't really have a social media presence before. So, you know, erasing what limited presence she had on the internet.
So what can regular Canadians do to try and protect themselves, or what's being done to try and protect Canadians in this situation?
Yeah, well, the security expert I talked to, you know, said we're living in an increasingly online world, and it's really hard to prevent your personal information from getting into the wrong hands. But, you know, watching for malware, making sure you have the proper firewalls in place, just being a little bit more you know, protective of that personal information and not, you know, putting it out there for the world to find. And then there's what Canada's doing as a whole, which is, you know, on Thursday, our Minister Goodell tabled a motion to form a committee as kind of like a watchdog for any kind of national securities issues in Canada. And last year, the RCMP reassigned 600 of its officers to terrorism files from other units. And in April, Trudeau said he was going to allocate $51 million over 3 years in helping counterterrorism capacities in the Middle East and Northern Africa. So, you know, things are being done. Canada's really ramped up its counterterrorism activity. It's, yeah, there are things in the works.
All right. Thanks very much, Nikki. Really appreciate this.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Maclean's writer Nikki Weert speaking about the ISIS kill list and a woman who was on that list but only found out after being contacted by Maclean's. Coming up after the break, when is it proper to use the term genocide? That was the subject of a heated debate on Parliament Hill this week over the actions of ISIS. One expert says the Trudeau government was offside. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. The use of the word genocide was hotly debated on Parliament Hill this week. The Conservatives introduced a motion calling on the House of Commons to denounce the so-called Islamic State, or ISIS, for genocide in its campaign of terror against minorities in northern Iraq. But Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and most of his Liberal caucus voted down the motion. Trudeau had been arguing that it was up to the United Nations, not any individual country, to decide when genocide was being committed. Conservatives, of course, slammed him for his reluctance to use that word. Then, later in the week, there was another twist. A UN study found that ISIS was indeed genocidal in its campaign against the Yazidis, a religious minority group. Foreign Affairs Minister Stéphane Dion promptly said that was enough for the Canadian government to agree to apply the word genocide. In the foyer of the House of Commons, Minister Dion was asked about the change in tune.
We believe that a genocide is happening, occurring against the Yazidi on the ground of the evidence provided by the report of an independent body of the United Nations. This is the proper way to do. And we have taken the lead a month ago, asking the Security Council to investigate and to make sure that the ones that have done these awful crimes will be prosecuted.
Why make that determination by itself? Why do we need the United Nations?
Because it's the proper way to do, to be sure that it's done through investigation by an independent body about the Yazidis.
To talk more about the use of the word genocide, I'm joined now by John Geddes, McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief. John, you recently reached out to a leading expert for his point of view on all of this.
Yeah, hi, Cormac. Yeah, I called a British law prof. His name is Philip Sands, not a household name around here, but he has a very acclaimed new book out this spring, attracting a lot of international attention. It's called East-West Street, On the Origins of Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity. So, you know, needless to say, Sands has some real insights into the word genocide, the legal application of it. But why don't we start here by listening to what he had to say about Prime Minister Trudeau's argument, the argument that he had to wait for a UN stamp of approval before wielding the G word. First voice you hear here is me putting the question to Professor Sands. Trudeau says it's not up to my government to call label something a genocide, so I'm not voting for this motion. It's up to international bodies to make that determination. You know, just on that point, you think that's ridiculous, I take it?
I think it's ridiculous. I think what a prime minister can say is, ultimately, it's for a court to decide whether the elements of a crime have been met to characterize it as a genocide. Mm. But on the basis of the information that is before me, I can say that these acts of killing and horror appear to be motivated by a genocidal intent, and on that basis, it looks to me like a genocide is happening.
Yeah, you wouldn't be preempting. Sorry to interrupt, but you wouldn't to say something like that. You're not trying to preempt the court's judgment. You're just introducing a perspective or a reading of what's actually happening. Yeah,
exactly. And no international, no judge at the ICC or the ICJ is going to care. That's what a Canadian or British Prime Minister or a U.S. Secretary of State calls it. Mm. They're going to have to deal with it on the case that's argued before them. Mm. So for political reasons, there's nothing in law to stop a Prime Minister of a country characterizing it as he or she wishes to characterize it.
So, John, it's pretty clear he's not on Team Trudeau with the decision on using that word. But Sands' book is about two terms, not just genocide, but also crimes against humanity. I think a lot of people would use those terms almost interchangeably.
Yeah, those are the terms we use, right, under not just international law, but also in kind of political debate when we're talking about the worst outrages. Both those expressions came into use back after the Second World War during the Nuremberg trials of Nazi leaders. Why don't we listen just briefly to Sands on that history, which is sort of what he's delving into in the book.
Every genocide will be a crime against humanity.
Right.
But not every crime against humanity will be a genocide. The essential difference is that crimes against humanity is concerned with the protection of individuals, and genocide is concerned with the protection of groups. Mm. The two men who gave rise to the legal use of those terms both produced the fruits of their labors in 1945. Crimes against humanity entered international law about 3 weeks before genocide. It was in the Nuremberg Statute, Article 6, Paragraph C, and that happened on the 6th of August, 1945. And genocide did not make it into the statute, but did make it into the indictment on the 18th of October, 1945, and thereafter it was part of the Nuremberg trial. Crimes against humanity was used throughout the trial. Genocide came and went. The judgment was handed down exactly 70 years ago, 30th of September, 1946, and the judgment does not mention the word genocide once.
So, Cormac, that's just a taste of the history that Sands has explored, but it isn't just history, right? It's current as well. It was only earlier this spring that U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry applied the word genocide to what ISIS was doing, and that attracted a lot of international attention. Here's Sands again, and this time he's talking about that example and how it shows that genocide as a term still has power.
If we're going to find that somebody's guilty of crimes against humanity, surely that's enough. Why do we have to debate whether it was genocide or not?
Couldn't agree with you more. But in the scheme of things, genocide has emerged as the crime of crimes. And two things to think about. In respect of victims, if the indictment and conviction is not genocide, victims tend to feel aggrieved that the horrors they've been subjected to are somehow less terrible than the others. And so there's a sort of Premier League, to take a soccer parlance,
yes,
of horrors, and victims want their horrors to be top of the table, not mid-table, so to speak.
I got you.
In relation to the prosecutor's second point, they come under intense pressure to indict for genocide rather than crimes against humanity for that reason. And third point, I can illustrate it. When in 2007, the International Court of Justice basically said that Serbia was not responsible for committing a genocide in relation to Bosnia and Srebrenica. In other words, it was done by people who weren't under their direction and control.
Right.
The very next day, the government-controlled newspapers basically said, quote, "We are innocent," end of quote. In other words, being found responsible for crimes against humanity and genocide, you're off the hook. The simple way to think about it is if Kerry had said crimes against humanity and war crimes are being committed in northern Iraq, it would have been on page 14.
Yes.
Because he used the G word, it's on page 1.
So the term genocide really hasn't lost its power to command our attention.
And no matter how inured, the public and politicians sometimes are to the worst kinds of violence in this age, it still makes you think. And Sands calls it not just the G word kind of lately, but also the crime of crimes. His book, that book again, is called East-West Street on the Origins of Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity. And obviously it's been getting a lot of raves and deserves some attention.
So, John, let me ask you a political question then, just on this. Is the fact that the government now concedes ISIS is committing genocide, does that basically soften the debate here? Or do you think the opposition is going to make sure that Canadians are reminded nonstop that the government was hesitant?
Yeah. I think probably the latter, right? The fact that they moved it happened so quickly, that even if it had been a week or 2 weeks later that this UN report came out that gave Dion, grounds for using the word genocide, I think it would have been different. But coming a couple days later, it did seem awfully awkward for the government. And this is the kind of file in which the Conservatives are going to want to suggest that somehow the Liberals lack backbone. Might add, though, that the NDP was on side with the Tory motion as well on this thing.
All right. Thank you very much, John. Really appreciate it.
Good to be here. Thanks, Cormac.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.